Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Dave Hughes, and he'll be answering your most important questions on nymphs for streams and still waters. The show will be 90 minutes in length. We're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. The broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc. Doing business is Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Dave Hughes about nymphs for streams and still waters. The Platte River Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming features a first-class website covering all aspects of fly fishing the tailwaters of the North Platte River, including up-to-date local fishing reports, fly patterns, guide services, and online shopping for top-of-the-line gear for any travel destination. The Platte River Fly Shop provides a professional guide staff for the Blue Ribbon, Trophy, Gray Reef, and Miracle Mile sections of the North Platte River. Visit their extensive website at www.wyotrout.com. That's wyotrout.com. Or call the Platte River Fly Shop at 307-237-5997. That's 307-237-5997. Well, before we introduce Dave, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we're going to be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So you have 2 chances to win with the drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Dave's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Just click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners for those drawings at the end of the show. And thanks to Stackpole Books, we'll also be giving away a copy of Dave Hughes' newest book, Nymphs for Streams and Still Waters. Now, here's how you can win that. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question is going to be about something that Dave and I have talked about during the show. And you must submit your answer along with your name, location, using the text box on our homepage, the same text box that you can use during the show to ask questions. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and whoever gets that correct answer in first at the end of the show will get this beautiful book that Dave's just published. It's just a gorgeous full-color, 300-plus pages, I think, of information on exactly what we're going to be talking about tonight. Tonight, our guest is Dave Hughes. Dave Hughes is the editor of Fly Fishing and Tying Journal and author of more than 20 books about fly fishing for trout. They include Classic Western Hatches, American Fly Tying Manual, Handbook of Hatches, Reading the Water, Tactics for Trout, Strategies for Stillwater, Dry Fly Fishing, Nymph Fishing, Fly Fishing Basics, Wet Flies, The Massive Trout Flies, Essential Trout Flies, Taking Trout, Trout from Small Streams, and Western Fly Hatches. That's a lot of writing. His latest book is titled Nymphs for Streams and Still Waters that we were just talking about, which has more than 300 pages of text and 1,000 color photos of naturals, nymphs, tying steps, and the types of water where you want to fish them. Dave was the founding president of Oregon Trout in 1983 and was awarded life membership in the Federation of Fly Fishers in 1985. He's a life member of the Fly Fishers Club of Oregon and his home club, the Rainland Flycasters in Astoria, Oregon. Dave is an accomplished amateur aquatic entomologist. His hobbies include collecting, identifying, and photographing aquatic insects that are fed upon by trout, as well as tying and fishing the flies that match those insects. He lives in Portland, Oregon with his wife and daughter. Dave, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're happy to have you on the show.
Thank you, Roger. It's good to be here. Thank you.
Good. Well, we have a lot to talk about, and Dave, if you'll do me a favor and talk as directly into your mic as possible there so we can hear you loud and clear, that would be greatly appreciated. Dave, you've written a lot of books. what can you say, right?
From listening to your introduction, I've written too many. What have I done?
I'm wondering how you get any fishing done with all that writing.
I do a lot of fishing. I was just out the other day. In fact, I was out with Rick Hafley.
So, oh, good.
I do enough fishing.
You do enough fishing, good. Okay, well
maybe never enough, but
Yeah. And never enough. Let's get started because we, and thanks to our listening audience, we have a ton of questions tonight. We're just overwhelmed with questions. I opened up my application on tonight and I saw even before the show started, we had two more questions by online live listeners tonight already and the show hadn't even started yet. So let's get started. And we're kind of basing this on your latest book, Dave, and talking about nymphs for streams and still waters. So luckily, T-Bone in Utah probably started out this whole thing with the right question for all of us, especially for people new to fly fishing, is what exactly are nymphs? What are we talking about here?
Well, nymphs, and Eddie Angle is smart about this. He uses the word nymph imitations. But what I use the term to mean are fly patterns that represent the larval stage or the pupal stage or the nymph stage of an insect. And those are divided into the larvae and pupae. They're insects that have complete metamorphosis. Nymphs are insects that don't have complete metamorphosis. They go right straight from the nymph stage to the adult. But when I use the term nymphs as fly patterns, they're underwater patterns that represent those. And they can also represent leeches, scuds, sow bugs, etc., aquatic sow bugs, of course. So I guess I've never really put it into words, but it's an imitation of a creature that lives under the water, usually a nymph or a larva or a pupa.
Okay. And that was, you kind of, I think, answered Steve's question from Colorado. He said he realizes that there's some are complete metamorphosis and others are not. He said, put me straight, though. What is the difference between larva and nymphal stage?
Well, again, if a larva is the first stage, the, I guess you'll say, continually growing stage of an insect that has complete metamorphosis, a butterfly or a beetle, we'll say, in the terrestrials. But among the insects, aquatic insects, it would be a caddis, usually down on the bottom. So those insects go through a pupal stage before they become adults, and in that pupal stage, they make that transformation from the larva to the adult. It allows a greater change from the larva to the adult. And if you think about a mayfly nymph or a stonefly nymph, which doesn't have that, it's got incomplete metamorphosis, the nymph looks very similar to the adult. You add wings, you got the adult, essentially. And that's about what happens. They got their wing pads, the wings come out, and they come out and they cast a shuck and they have wings, and they look a lot like the nymph stage. But in the larva, there's a big difference between a larva, say a caddis, and an adult caddis in appearance. And that's the adaptation there in nature is to allow that greater change and therefore an adaptation to greater number of environments.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's a long answer to a simple question. A nymph doesn't complete metamorphosis, a larva does.
Yeah. I know in your book you take an approach and you use the term in the first part of your book. The title is part one, The Way Nymphing Shapes Itself. Could you kind of talk to that, what your general approach is to nymphing and philosophy around nymphing?
Yeah, you know, it's a big book, 375 pages. But I think in all of my books, I tend to try to simplify things. I try to look at the whole picture and then draw out of that what's the important part. And what I draw out of nymphs, when I looked at this, I broke nymphs down into two boxes of nymphs for moving water. One is a searching box of nymphs. If you have that searching box of nymphs, they're the beadheads, the copper johns, et cetera, then that's the box actually to fish out of most of the time on moving water. And then the second box you want is certain imitations for certain insects that become important at specific times, and you need to imitate them when fish get onto them. In moving water, I break it down that simply into you need searching nymphs, you need imitative nymphs. Most of the time you need searching nymphs, honestly speaking. We could do most of our fishing out of a box of searching nymphs. In fact, I do most of my fishing out of a box of searching nymphs that I have sitting in front of me right now. And then the third box you would need would be a separate box for still waters because still water insects happen to be quite a bit different from most moving water insects. And trout often get a better look at them in moving water, so you need to be more imitative. So I guess the way nymphing shapes itself is that I break it down into those three categories. Searching nymphs, you need a box of searching nymphs. That's really your primary box. And secondly, you need a box of imitative nymphs for moving water. And third, you need a box of imitating nymphs for still waters. It's different from your box for moving waters because there'll be different insects. So
right.
When I use the way nymphing shapes itself, that's what I'm talking about is those three fly boxes essentially.
Okay. Now, let's talk about flies for a bit, and then we can talk about fishing techniques and so forth, because that seems to be the big interest here of folks. This is the age-old question on one of our shows from Jared Sartini in Holland, Michigan. What's your favorite nymph? What's that go-to nymph that you'll put on if you know nothing else?
Well, Jared, that changes from day to day. But no, for consistently over the years, my favorite nymph, and I wrote about it in the book, is Dave Whitlock's fox squirrel with a bead head on it. I catch a tremendous number of trout on that thing. And just have for 20, 30 years now, I've caught fish on that. And a size 16 bead head fox squirrel will be what I tie on first if I don't know what else to do. But recently I've been catching a lot of fish on a lightning bug, which is a fly designed by Larry Graham for the Yakima River, but I've been catching fish all over the country on that thing, about a size 14. So currently I might lean toward that, or very commonly I'd put the lightning bug in a size 14 up above the size 16 beadhead fox on the same rig. So the answer is the beadhead fox squirrel is my favorite nymph.
Okay. Doesn't that, for some people have to do, we always talk about the confidence factor. I know, too, in your book you talked about two flies. You tested one against the other, one on top, one below, and then reversed them and reversed the way that they were tied. And yet you seem to catch as many fish on one as the other. Is there that confidence factor in play for us?
Well, it's huge, Roger. You know, my confidence factor in Dave Whitlock's fox squirrel goes back to the fact it was when I had that, I think we all have that epiphanic moment where suddenly we're catching fish on nymphs and it's working. And that's the fly that I had on the day that suddenly I was catching fish on nymphs. That's been a long time ago. And I still have that confidence when I put that fly on, I'm going to catch fish on it. So it's critical.
Yeah, I know. Always, for me, it's been from days past, the hair's here. It just seems I want anything else, that always works. So you go back
not
to
much
it.
Difference
yeah.
between a, not much difference between a beadhead fox squirrel and a beadhead hair's ear.
That's right. Yeah, similar.
My guess
buggy,
is
fuzzy.
Almost interchangeable.
Yeah. Don in Bozeman, Montana says, do you have a favorite nymph pattern types? Not of a particular insect form, but a style of nymph pattern. Soft tackle, fur, whatever.
Well, I really like Don's thinking in terms of types. I think in terms of pattern styles almost all the time. And that's the way I address them in the book. But I think you want to have not necessarily a favorite one, but you want to have a few favorite ones that, one would be the Copper John, and that would be a completely different type than, say, the beadhead fox squirrel, and then the lightning bug would be more like the Copper John. But, of course, I fish in a lot of salmon fly country, so I want salmon flies. So I break it down into fern nymphs and twisted strand nymphs and the wire-bodied nymphs and et cetera. But I think you want to have not a favorite pattern type, but you want to have two or three or four pattern types that you want to have a representative of. You have your, you have your gold-ribbed hares here. I have my fox squirrel. I have my lightning bug, and I use the Copper John a lot, and then I use the bigger salmon fly. So those are three different types, but I want a representative of each of those types, and I want a hurl nymph like the prince. So I don't want to have one favorite type. I guess it would be my beadhead fox squirrel if I had one favorite. But I wouldn't want to be without that range of types and a representative of each of those types in my fly box.
I noticed one thing in your book that, you see so many midge imitations that are pretty much, thread on a hook. And yet you had those furry type midge imitations. And there's where there's a big contrast between the two styles there, I thought.
Well, I've caught a lot of fish on those fur things over the years. I'd say now that I'm going more toward the thread midge type and the zebra midge with the glass bead, the mercury glass bead. But I think that goes back to that confidence that we talked about earlier. I've just got so much confidence in those flies that have caught fish for me over the years. And we used to use those fur nymphs, and I still use them because they still catch fish.
Right.
But there is the thread midges are more imitative of the midge pupae, that's for sure.
Okay, okay. Scott Nelson, Portland, Oregon, who I think you know, has his question. He says, unlike your colleague Rick Cafel, who you have referred to in the past as a bottom feeder, and I don't know exactly what that means, but you are not known to be a nymph fisherman, but rather a fly fisher who uses dries or wets much higher in the water column. When and where do you fish using deep nymphing techniques, and what are your personal go-to nymphs for the bottom?
Well, first, I don't want Scotty coming between me and Rick here, because Rick and I have been friends for a long time. So let's say, Scott, if I can have your permission, let's say I've referred to Rick as a bottom fisher, not a bottom feeder.
Not a bottom feeder.
And another thing I'd like to point out, since we're on the subject of Hafley, it's pronounced Hafley, by the way. It's just like Hafley always says, it's just like calling a flea, Hafley. So, but his book that came out a year before mine, his book is Nymph Fishing Rivers and Streams, and it's heavy to tactics. And my book is Nymphs for Streams and Still Waters, and it's obviously heavy to the fly patterns, although I do talk about the fishing, obviously, how to fish them. But I want to point out that they're pretty complementary books. So if you get one, I'd like to have you get the other, just, you know, partially because I want to keep Rick as a friend here. But anyway, but Scott's right, and I'm more known as a dry fly fisherman and wet fly fisherman, et cetera, higher in the water column. But and when and where do I fish using deep nymphing methods? I think it's more the when than it is the where. Actually, Hafley and I were just on the Deschutes January 16th. It was a really cold, foggy day, but not windy, so we fished. But we had an incredible Betis hatch for about 2 hours from about noon to two. And we fished dry flies when that was happening. But before the hatch, there was nothing going on, and we both used nymphs, and we both caught fish on them. And then when the hatch started, we switched over, and fish started rising. We caught a few fish on the dry flies. So it's more conditions. And what I would say is when I use nymphs, is when conditions kind of deny me the hope that I'm going to catch fish on the surface or just subsurface, which is a lot of the time. So as time goes on, more and more I fish nymphs and because I want to fish in those circumstances. And I want to add one more thing. After the hatch, we were so cold we quit fishing. So I was going to say before and after the hatch we fished nymphs. But after the hatch, we got to the fireplace.
You kind of identified a few of your favorites, but maybe we can start to detail out those boxes that you've created. Dan Weibarger, I guess, is in Illinois. He says, I'm new to nymph fishing. What are a few good nymphs to have in my box as I head down to some streams in northeast Iowa? Thanks, Dan. Now, I'm wondering if he's fishing for trout or if he's fishing for smallmouth in Iowa.
Well, I'm guessing there's some awfully good trout fishing in Iowa, so I'm going to guess he's trout fishing.
Okay.
I think he would have said smallmouth if he wasn't. So, Dan, we're going to assume you're trout fishing here. If we get to it, we'll talk about nymphs and smallmouth later. There was a question on it. But, Dan, my answer here would be make sure that you have some small nymphs, especially you're going to be looking at spring creeks where you are and smaller streams. So make sure you've got some size 16, 18s, and 20s. Maybe even a 22 in there. Make sure you've got that covered. And a big nymph in your area would be a size 12 and a 14. So make sure you've got that distinction that you really want to have some small nymphs. And then I'm looking at my box now. You know, I've got lightning bugs, obviously, and Dave Whitlock's fox squirrel. I've got a lot of tiny Betis patterns in here that I don't know they even have a name. Some have wire bodies and some have, they have counterwound pheasant tail bodies. Those are good. Actually, there's a...
Dave, excuse me for a second. I'm getting messages on the internet saying you're hard to hear, so if you could speak up as loudly as you can, that'd be great.
Okay, I actually had to go out and buy a phone for this operation, so it's a new phone. Is that coming out better?
It sounds fine to me, but they're having trouble hearing it over the internet, so...
Okay, well, I'll try to speak
up. It sounds better to me, so keep at that volume if you can.
Okay, so... You know, the one other thing I have here is very often I'll use a, especially on small streams, I'll use about a size 12 black bead-headed nymph, and usually it'll be an all-purpose AP black, and I'll use that as my bigger fly to get the smaller one down. So I guess what I'm pointing out here, Dan, is you, more than what exact patterns do you want to have, what you want to make sure you have is some size 12, 14s that are fairly heavily weighted, and you want to have some really size 16, 18s, and 20s, really tiny, what you think of as tiny, but never overlook the fact that trout can see those tiny things down there, or they wouldn't get to be big, and they wouldn't survive. So we always tend to think that, wow, this is so small, a trout's not going to be able to see it. But rather than answer your question by specific nymph patterns, I just want to point out that you should have some medium-sized flies, 12, 14, and then make sure you have some 16, 18s, and 20s, and use those. Almost always you should have a small fly as one of your two-fly combination down there. Make sure you got a small fly out there and you're offering a small fly to the trout all the time. Actually, it's fairly rare to use something big. We'll use a bigger one to imitate a salmon fly or something that's present, and you can see it and you need to imitate it. But it'd be pretty rare, unless something like that's going on, that I'd have a bigger size 8 or something on. So small is golden.
Good, good. Pete Gramp, and kind of carry this forward, Pete Gramp in Pennsylvania says, asks, please talk about what nymphs you head towards first, and more important to me at least is the why. That is, please explain the thought process you go through when choosing which nymph to put on the end of your leader.
Well, the first answer is that very often when I go to a stream, I'll start off by collecting and seeing what's predominant out there. And if something's predominant out there, then at least one of my flies will be a pretty close imitation of it. So it might be a green rockworm, it might be a salmon fly, it might be a mayfly nymph that's getting ready to emerge. But at any rate, the first thing I'll do is try to see what's predominant in the river. And if there is something really predominant, then I'll try to match it with one of my flies. The other one will be small, like I just answered to Dan's question. What nymphs I head toward most or first are the ones that have been working for me the most, and that gets right back to my beadhead fox squirrel, my lightning bug. If I don't have any indication from my collecting that I should do anything imitative, then I'm going to tie on a size 14 lightning bug and probably a size 16 or 18 beadhead fox squirrel, because those have worked so often for me in so many circumstances.
Well, you also said, I believe in your book, I believe I read this, that you like to have that smaller and larger fly on a tandem rig, I guess, because I got the impression you were saying that the trout are opportunistic when they're feeding down there, and that if it looks like food coming by, they're not as maybe, you know, hatch specific, so to speak, matching the hatch when they're feeding on nymphs as when they're feeding on the surface. Do I have that right?
Well, I think that's exactly right, and I've said that. I know that there's other people that say you have to be as imitative or more imitative under the surface, but I don't feel like that's true in my own fishing. I feel like trout are seeing something come down on the drift, and a lot of times they'll just try it, see if it's good to eat or not, spit it out if it isn't. That's why you miss so many. But at any rate, they see a lot more small things than they do big ones. So, again, I keep going back to that small. But I don't think you need to be as imitative as you do on the surface. I think you do need to be, you need to offer them a choice. You need to give them something large and something small. And usually when I say large, I mean something 12 or 14, something medium and something small, maybe something bright and something drab, maybe something heavily weighted, your larger fly heavily weighted, and your smaller dropper fly very lightly weighted. Typically when I weight a nymph, I underweight it. And if I'm using a beadhead, I use just maybe 8 or 10 turns of really fine non-lead wire just to jam up into that bead and lock it in.
So add a little extra weight, yeah.
Yeah, I don't weight them heavily. I would rather do what I call underweighting them and give myself the choice of. I think we get into questions later.
There was quite a few questions on weighting. There is one, since you just mentioned beadhead, Andrew Olnek asks on the internet here, came in on the internet, do you prefer a certain bead head color?
I do. I prefer gold. But let me preface that by saying that there's a lot of evidence now that fish that have seen a lot of bead heads are starting to back away from them, bright ones. And that would be on rivers like, in my own experience, the Bighorn River in Montana. If you use a gold bead on the Bighorn, you're almost reducing your chances of catching fish. So all my flies for that river are going to go to black, usually black tungsten. And that might be true on a river like the Delaware or heavily fished spring creek anywhere. Heavily fished water, you might find, trout adapt. And I think that they might be starting to learn that these beads aren't the best thing in the world for them. So My favorite color, because I'm out here in the unruly west right now, is a gold bead. But that may change in the next 5 or 10 years, maybe a black.
Good thing to test on a tandem rig, huh?
That would be a wonderful test, and it's very difficult to make that kind of test, but it would be good for somebody to tie the same fly with a gold bead and a black bead and fish it on their water and mm-hmm. see what the difference is.
Right, right. Kevin in Kutzer in Wilson, Wyoming wants to know, how much or do water flow rates impact your size choices when fishing nymphs?
You know, I have to say no. I think they don't. I think I'm more impacted by what I've collected. I'm more going to go with those, back to that consistent, one's going to be a 14 and one's going to be a 16 or an 18
mm-hmm.
double fly rig. And if I haven't mentioned it, and I don't mention it later, Hafley and I have been doing, and I've heard that other people have been doing this too, experiments where we fish two nymphs and we catch a certain number of fish and then we take one of them off because the other one's working really well. And the other one's not, and we'll take off the one that's not working, and our take will go way down on the one we leave on. So there's something about the two-nymph rig that produces more strikes. So that's something to bear in mind.
And maybe it could be they see one go by, catches their attention, and they see the second one take it.
Yeah, I don't think I can get into the psychology of what's going on down there yet, but we do have that result, and I think it's something to pay attention to.
Yeah. Jim in Jefferson City, Missouri says, my son has a close friend of college who's from Middlesbrough, England. This talented young fly fisher has introduced both of us to epoxy buzzers. Although these midge peep imitations are primarily used for still water trout fishing back in England, we found them to be highly effective on trout here in Ozark Spring Creeks. Would you please discuss these flies? And I was wondering if you included them in your new book.
Well, Jim's got me there. I fished his Ozark Spring Creeks, but not with the, I don't know the epoxy buzzers.
Okay.
So I think they, just from those two words put together, they have to be midge pupa patterns, and they've got to be extremely effective. I would kind of assume, just guessing, that they're a thread midge with epoxy on the thorax area. It would be extremely effective. It would give some reflectance of light and et cetera.
Jim, maybe you could send us more information about that fly, you know, pictures or recipes to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, and I'll share that with Dave, and we can learn a few things there. So,
yeah, Jim, a reference would be great on that, where you're getting patterns for them. I'd love to have that.
Another one on flies. I've read that there are times when trout key in on molting nymphs. I'm wondering if you've had any experience fishing pale/cream mayfly or stonefly imitation. I guess trying to simulate the molting or the
I do
emergent.
Fish them. I don't think I'm fishing them to simulate that. I I'm a photographer and I do a lot of collecting and photography. And I do get pictures of those once in a while, mostly golden stones for some reason. And they're very pale, bright. I have a picture of one in the book, in fact. Very pale, creamy, like it said here. A beautiful thing. But I really don't think trout get to see enough of those to get selective to them. What I think they do is they recognize them as a really juicy, easy bite, and when they get a chance at one, they really nail it. So I think you're not imitating that insect because trout are selective to it. It would be very, almost, I can't think of a situation in which you would find that a trout was just eating those and passing up everything else. But if a trout got a chance at one, he would certainly not pass it up. So the answer might be more that those are effective because trout aren't going to pass them up when they see them. And they might be easier for the trout to see than, say, a drab imitation of a normal colored nymph.
Right. Well, Dave, we need to take a quick break here. But when we come back, we'll be talking with Dave Hughes more about fishing with nymphs. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. Keeney's Fly Shop has an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. Or you can call them at 1-800-400-0359. Again, that's 1-800-400-0359. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Dave Hughes about nymphs for streams and still waters. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Dave, before we jump back in to the nymphs, tell us a little bit about what you've been up to lately in the fly fishing world. Tell us about this new book that you just published and anything else you're involved with.
Well, Nymphs for Streams and Still Waters, it's, like I said, 375 pages. It's all color. It's got pictures of the naturals, and it's got the imitations, and then the steps in tying the imitations. I guess maybe that's the critical thing to point out, is that it is a fly tying book. I think that in the how nymphing shapes itself that we already talked about, I give kind of a philosophy of how to select fly patterns and what kind of fly patterns you'd want to use. And then it goes into the specific fly patterns and whether they're searching or imitative and how to tie them. And then each chapter concludes, or each section concludes, with a small section on what might be a favorable condensation of all the flies I've talked to about into a fly box that covers that category in nymphs. So it's kind of looking at a broad scope of nymphs and then trying to help you pick what would work in your waters. Everything is related. Ed Angle says this all the time. All fishing is regional. So you want to pick what works on your own waters. As far as what I've been up to, after I finished that book, I went straight in and had cataract surgery. And I'm just getting back into tying now. That was, everybody says that you get cataract surgery and you're tying flies 2 days later, but it didn't work that way for me. I had a lot of trouble with mine, and I'm just getting back now to where I can tie well.
So, well, between tying and writing, that's a lot of use of your eyes, that's for sure.
It is, yeah, it is, and I read a lot. I do a lot of reading.
Yeah.
I'm going to take a year off. This was a big book that took two and a half years to do, and I was learning digital photography as I went, so I did some hair pulling, getting this thing together. Stackpole did a beautiful job. I'm really just...
Oh, yeah, it's gorgeous. I was going to ask you, you said that you're working on a website and will be coming up here in the future. It's not quite ready yet, but do you want to share that,
that
web address for future reference?
It'll be DaveHughesFlyFishing.com, and it's being put together right now, so if you went to it today, you would find it, but you wouldn't find much on it. But hopefully within a week or two, there'll be something to look at there. And,
okay. DaveHughesFlyFishing.com.
Pretty simple.
Yep. Great. Well, let's jump back in here and talk about nymphing. Gary Richardson in Michigan wants to know, are soft tackle flies fished almost the same as you'd fish a basic nymph?
You know, I would put it kind of reverse out. Sometimes I fish a basic nymph the same way I'd fish a soft tackle, but a soft tackle is a wet fly, and I fish them on the swing very much like you'd fish for summer steelhead. Cast them out quartering across the current and fish them down, mend to slow them, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm using the old wet fly techniques for those. And I fish with Sylvester Nemus, by the way, who wrote The Soft Tackle Fly, and he fishes them the same way, casting them across and letting them swing down and around. So the answer is I don't fish them at all like you would fish a traditional nymph or a basic nymph. I fish them very differently. And I do want to say that Sylvester Nemus, The Soft Tackle Fly, one of the best books ever written about fly fishing. It's one of those wonderful books that is a great read. It really prods you to go to the vise and tie these things. And then you tie them, and it really, they just are beautiful little flies, and they make you want to go fish them. And then darned if you don't go out and catch fish on them. So that's a wonderful book. And this winter, if you haven't read it, reward yourself by reading that book, The Soft Tackle Fly.
Great. Ken Bear in Whitehall, Montana asks, he says his hooks get dulled from bumping the bottom as he fishes. Do you have a preference as to what style hook you tie your nymphs with?
I can get in trouble with hook manufacturers here if I get specific. But
okay.
I tie on the heavy curved scud hook, not the light one, the heavy one. I'll give a number here, the Tiemco 2487. Or similar. All the manufacturers make one. Make sure you use the heavy one. Holds fish better. That's for a lot of my nymphs, midge pupae, scud patterns, et cetera, and even some mayflies and stuff like that. And then the other one is the, we'll say 1X long, 2X heavy. And again, TMC 3761 would be the typical number. But again, all the manufacturers have that same style hook. And then if I'm tying a long nymph like a salmon fly, then I'll use 3X long, 2X heavy, and sometimes 4X long. But those are for the long ones. So those would be the three primary hooks that you'd want to have for nymph tying.
Okay. We've got a question from Dan in Illinois. Are nymphs predominantly a pattern for trout, or can they also be used for smallmouth?
Well, they are predominantly for trout, but they're extremely effective on smallmouth. I tied a bunch of Polly Rossborough's casual dress last year. I did an article on Polly for a Japanese magazine last year. Wound up tying a bunch of his casual dresses in size 6 for the photos and stuck them in my smallmouth box instead of my trout box and went smallmouth fishing, and the fish just hammered them. I really were more effective than the streamers I'd typically used or the poppers. So the answer is yes. That particular Polly Rossborough's casual dress is a very effective smallmouth in my own experience. I don't have a broader experience with nymphs than that, but very effective.
Okay. Kevin in Wilson, Wyoming again said, will you please discuss the knot or knots that you use when fishing with nymphs? And if your choice of knots is variable, and what would drive your decision process for choosing different knots? And he's asking, I think, about tandem rigs and so forth, of how you put those together, if there's a specific way.
Yeah, typically I would be lazy and use the improved clinch on my bigger nymph and a two-nymph rig. But the Duncan loop gives your fly some freedom. It lets it move around down there, and I think a loop knot is very important. So I would say I use the Duncan loop most of the time and the improved clinch a lot of the times, and especially when I'm lazy. But I guess if I was never lazy, I would always use the Duncan loop. That's a bad answer. But the Duncan loop, a loop knot is very important in nymph fishing. So I would definitely...
Well, the age-old question on a tandem rig, then, are you tying to the bend in the hook for the point fly? Are you tying that to the bend in the hook of the fly in front?
When you're tying to the bend of the hook, you have to tie an improved clinch there because a loop knot would just
right.
kind of slip out.
But right.
then when you tie to the eye of the hook down to the dropper, then definitely use a Duncan loop at that end.
But my question was, are you tying to the bend of the hook? And it sounds like you are.
I am, yes. Yes, I
yeah.
am. That's
some people tie to the eye of the first fly or something like that.
I don't do that. I don't.
Yeah.
I can't say that I have a reason I don't, but I don't.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You talked about the three fly boxes that you basically work with all the time, the searching box, the imitative box for streams, and then you have a stillwater box. Does that really cover all the bases for you? I assume you, of course, has, you know, dry flies and so forth, but as far as nymphs go?
It covers the nymph bases for me to an extent, and of course I have a dry fly box, but I also carry two or three small boxes almost always. They're specific to hatches. If I'm out on an Oregon stream in March, well, I think the March Browns might be hatching. I have a box that's got dry flies and MC mergers, et cetera, specifically for March Browns. I have another one for Betis and Pale Morning Duns and one for Midges. So kind of thinking what I'm targeting that day, what I expect to have happen, I'll have two or three small boxes, each one dedicated to a specific hatch in it.
Okay. Let's take a quick break here, Dave, and when we come back, we'll be talking more about tactics and so forth for using nymphs on streams and still waters. Federation of Fly Fishers has an online fundraising auction going on right now. Find everything from guided fishing trips and fly casting lessons to equipment, FFF memorabilia, and more. Go to the FF website at fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org on the homepage. You'll click on the banner for the holiday online auction. New items are added each week, so keep checking them out, and you may get that trip of a lifetime, that rod you've always wanted, or a collection of flies tied by the masters. Many items are going for prices you won't want to miss. So go to fedflyfishers.org, check out the online auction, and good luck bidding. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support, so please support them and become a member. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Dave Hughes about nymphs for streams and still waters. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and send us your question. We'll try to answer it on the show tonight. Okay, Dave, we're getting through these questions, but we got a lot of them to go and a lot of them coming in online. Let's talk a little bit about tactics here. I think we've answered Robert's question from Albuquerque about how you choose flies and rig them based upon what you observe on the river that day, and you've said you go check the river and look for what's in it, and I think that kind of answers that question.
You know, we could address as how to rig them. I think that's
okay.
Good,
go ahead. Go ahead.
Question. And just briefly, Robert, typically rig with an indicator down to the larger fly and then a split shot and then between the two flies and then the smaller fly. And the distance between those two flies might be just 8 or 10 inches. I don't tie 18 inches between them or anything. So that would be a basic rig, and I just wanted to answer that half of Robert's question really quickly.
Well, you just said you have the first fly and then you put the weight between the two flies?
Very often I do that. And I'm talking about pretty small shot here.
Okay.
And then, you know, another part of the time I'll go down to a tippet knot, and then I'll put one or two shot there jammed against that knot, and then I'll go 8 or 10 inches to the bigger fly, and then 8 or 10 inches more to the smaller fly. That's the second
okay.
rig. But I guess the key here is I'm rigging the standard split shot and indicator rig.
Most
of the time.
I know we have questions here about, and might as well talk about that now when we're talking about this tandem rig. Kevin in Wilson, Wyoming, could you please discuss, and we've got several questions on this. I don't want to ignore people, but there's a whole bunch of these on from Fraser Perry in Sydney, Australia, Mike in Potomac, Maryland, Ken Patterson in Ontario, Canada, all wanting to know about your use and selection and type of strike indicators. So could you kind of go through your system?
Yeah, I'm kind of a yarn guy first, yellow yarn or white yarn first, if I can support what I'm fishing, which isn't always. And being out here from steelhead country, we use a lot of steelhead corkies, which are just a ball of cork that's covered and then painted orange and has a hole in it. And we use a toothpick to hold it on. And that's a good option because with the yarn indicator, you can't adjust it up and down very easily. With a toothpick holding on an indicator, you can move that indicator up and down your leader. And you do need to be able to adjust as you go from different water types. And then recently I've been using the balloon indicators. That was another question we had. And I've just been using them for a couple of years. And I find they're really effective. They give a good support to your fly, and they're going to float. You're going to be able to see them. They're going to hold up there. I fish a lot of rough water, and you're going to be able to see that balloon indicator. And I like them. So I didn't think I would. But I do, so I've been using them quite a bit. So those would be the three main types that I use, would be yarn, especially in fine situations, and the steelhead corkies we use a lot. That's just traditional here, and there's a lot of indicators that are similar to those. And that balloon indicator, I'm using that more and more. I like that.
Brian in Birmingham, Alabama, wants to know about how to set your strike indicator. He says he's heard that it should be twice as deep as the water that you're fishing. Is that true, or is there some other logic?
Yeah, that's a good question, and there were other questions that said it's 2.5 times the right depth. And the answer is it depends on the current speed more than anything. If the current's whipping along, you got to be 2.5. If the current's real slow, you got to be maybe just one time, one depth of the water. I wrote an article for Field and Stream one time, and I said you adjust your indicator and your shot depending, or your length of the distance between them and the amount of weight you have on, depending on the current speed. And there was a letter to the editor from somebody in Massachusetts who fished a stream that I happened to have fished, and he said he was casting out and his fly just goes to the bottom and sits there. And I had fished that stream and I knew how slow the water was in that stream, and I thought, you know, if your fly is any more than one depth of the water from your indicator, you're going to be hung up. So you have to adjust it depending on the current speed, not the current depth or the water depth, but the current speed. The faster the current, the more distance between your flies and your indicator.
Okay. Pete Gramp in Pennsylvania says, I'll ask the proverbial gotta ask question. Strike indicator, multiple fly rig, a large dry fly to use as a strike indicator, or neither. And so I guess he's kind of asking here, you know, what about a large dry fly for an indicator? Is that something that you use? Or
I use that a lot. and especially on smoother water and slower current speeds. I'll use that a lot. That gives trout a different choice. You might find that you're catching them on the dry fly once in a while. But usually the dry fly that will support the amount of weight you've got down there is going to be big enough that trout in a selective situation aren't going to take it. So that dry fly is good. I use a lot of dry and dropper when I'm exploring, when I don't know what's going on. So I like an indicator of some type. And very often, if it's a situation where I just want to suspend a bead head or something on about 2 feet of tippet, I'll use a dry fly to do that very, very commonly.
Question that I'm backing up a bit. Brian in Wisconsin wants to know how important it is to fish the double rig tandem, you know, dry dropper combo, versus just sticking with a single fly. He says he hears conflicting opinions about, you know, using either one. Sounds like you're a tandem rig kind of guy.
Definitely, if it's legal and moral and et cetera, I'll be using two flies. And I don't very often use three because I get tangled up too much. But the dry and dropper I use a lot for exploring. And I just had an experience, I think it was September. I was on a small mountain stream. The water was still fairly cold, and I wasn't catching anything on the surface when I thought I should be. There was a lot of hoppers around. And I wasn't catching anything, and I thought, wow, what's going on here? And it was a little bit early in the day. And I tied on a dropper and was just instantly into fish after fish after fish, just the standard bead head, and just caught fish after fish. So, and then the other thing I'll point out in relation to Brian's question is that again, back to our experiments where we found that if we're catching fish, we've got two nymphs on, and we're catching fish on just one of them, we take the other one off, and suddenly we stop catching fish. So I don't know why, but I do know that that's the case. So that's why I'm a two-nymph guy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We had, again, backing up here in our questions a bit, there was a question from John Ferguson in New York. What nymphs would you use at what water temperatures for stream fishing? So I guess, he's asking, does water temperature make a difference as to your nymph selection?
You know, it wouldn't, John. It would be more related to what I collected. And if the water temperatures are cold, I'm going to make sure I have a real small fly on. Again, I would just go back to that size 14, size 16, or 18 combination. But I don't think it's based on the water temperature. I think it's more based on what I collect from the stream and making sure I have something on there that's small. So that would kind of answer that question, is I don't think water temperature affects what nymph I would use. What I find in the stream would affect it.
Which is what you find is going to tell you about the water temperature as well. For instance, you know, a hatch starting to come off or something.
That's a very good point.
You know, in many places, it doesn't pay to even start fishing too early in the morning. You know, they talk about that on the Arkansas River in Colorado for the caddis, because the caddis, the water doesn't warm up enough for them to start hatching, and then that's when things start happening, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they say go have a really nice, big, good breakfast, take your time, and then go out on the river. So.
Well, that's one reason I like fly fishing.
Well, let's see here. Couple other questions here. This is an interesting one. Gary Powell in Memphis, he divides his time, I guess, between Memphis, Tennessee, and Jacksonville, Wyoming. Mr. Hughes, we talk about a drag-free drift in nymphing. However, an indicator will pull the nymphs as soon as they enter the water. Vladdy, who's one of the originators of the European nymphing techniques, he says, in Polish nymphing, pulls his rig slightly faster than the current speed, so he's pulling it through the current. Is the issue that the drift should be drag-free or that it should be with the current rather than cross-current?
Well, my speculation is that a nymph moving across the current is moving contrary to the way a natural would move. And some trout might be attracted to that. They might say, wow, that's alive. I'm going after it. But I think most might say, oop, that's not natural. It's kind of like a drag on a dry fly, you could say, if it's moving contrary to the current. It's moving a little faster than the current or a little slower. I think that's more of a natural movement because current has a lot of, well, what do we want to call it, turbulence down there where this fly will speed up, lift up, it'll drop down and slow down. But that turbulence wouldn't normally drive it side to side. Maybe it would sometimes. But I think a side to side movement with the current would be more unnatural. And again, I'm speculating because I don't do diving, but I think that it would be more critical to have it, as Vladdy says, in line with the current. I think that would be critical.
What about, how do you explain then the down and across, you know, with a soft tackle fly, or even with, you know, all of us have caught fish on the tail out when that line's going across current. What's happening there under the water?
Well, I think it's that lifting and movement toward the surface of an emerging insect. But again, even when you do that, typically, two things, when you're doing that with a nymph, typically it's at the end of your drift and you're lifting it up, and that's kind of pulling it straight toward the surface. So it would be pulling it toward you somewhat. When you're fishing a wet fly on the swing, that's up in the surface area. I think it's more of a natural movement up there. But that's kind of suspicious reasoning. I think that I still stick with my idea that down on the bottom with a nymph, it's going to be a lot better off if it's moving with the current than if it's moving across it.
Abe Bauer in Livermore, California, he says, in your opinion, with all things being equal in regards to natural drift, being in the feeding lane and proper fly dimension, does a fly with some type of flashing material consistently outperform one that doesn't? Copper John comes to mind, he says.
Well, I have to say it does. I'm looking at my fly box now, and almost every fly in this box that I tied this winter has a bead on it or some flash on the body. I'm almost embarrassed to look at it. But, yes, I think it does. And I think the reason is that a lot of insects, when they get ready to emerge, they exude nitrogen between the exoskeleton of the pupa on the outside or the nymph on the outside and the adult, which is already on the inside. So there is some natural bubbles of air there. There's some natural brightness on most of these insects that come up. So I think that the brightness, number one, attracts the fish's attention to that thing so that they just see it where they might not have otherwise. And second, it does have its counterpart in nature. So I think fish are apt to take it. So most of the time, but there is that kind of codicil to the thing where I said a bright bead head on the Bighorn River starting to back trout away.
Right,
so
right.
Right now my answer is yes, I think that a brightness on the fly helps.
Right. We got a question in on the internet. Dennis Cluck in Harpersville, New York asks, Dave, what type of nymphing method would you employ on long, slow pools found on most rivers? I am having trouble approaching fish in this type of water where you can get close enough to cast and control your drift without spooking them.
Well, I guess what's a long, slow pool and the problem is spooking them, that kind of indicates to me that it's a long, slow, shallow pool or that the trout are hanging up toward the top. And I think you're going to have to almost apply dry fly tactics there where you make your cast well upstream from the fish with a long leader. And maybe this is a situation, it just sounds surely like a situation where you need to have a real long leader, long fine tippet, a bead head or a lightly weighted fly. And critical here would be a white yarn indicator or something that's not going to spook the fish. I think we're seeing a lot of situations, especially in the kind that Dennis describes where you have a long, slow pool on a heavily fished stream. Those fish have seen a lot of indicators come over their heads, and they know that something's wrong there. And a piece of white yarn is going to look like a piece of foam coming over them. So I think if you really fine down your gear, cast well upstream of the fish to give your nymph time to sink, and use a really small yarn indicator, just enough to float while that fly sinks, that would probably be critical in that situation. So I think finding down the rig and the tactics in that situation is what's called for.
And a real stealth approach to begin with, right?
Yeah, the stealth approach, just like you use in New Zealand, sneak up on them, keep low, and keep your rod out of their sight, et cetera.
Right. Another question on the internet came through. Brandon in Advanced, North Carolina says, how do you develop feel, he says feel in quotes, when nymph fishing? Outside the obvious, what is the trick to knowing you have a fish hooked?
I'm sorry, but I love North Carolina, by the way. I get down there whenever I can. It's a lot of experience, a lot of experience. I always say that the more you know, the more you can imagine, and the more experience you have, the more often you're going to know what's going on out there. a lot of it's experience in watching your indicator and just developing that. It's not even a sense, but it sounds like a sense. But something told you that that indicator moved, and it's just watching it and having enough experiences that it moved and you set the hook, and indeed there was a fish there. Until you get that experience, you set the hook every time the indicator does anything that it shouldn't do according to the current. But it's a good answer in one way, in that the only solution to getting that experience is to go out fishing more.
And I think that's every time when I fish with somebody who's had more experience, I notice they have that sixth sense, because you can fish the same run, stand next to you, use the same things, but a guy that's been on the water more always seems to catch more fish. It's been my experience.
I just read the book Blink by Malcolm Gladwell.
Oh yeah, great book.
It applies to fishing if you think about it, because he doesn't talk about blink being a decision you just toss off. He talks about you learn to make decisions in a blink by building up your experience with those kinds of decisions and your ability to make them. So a lot of fishing is that. You have a lot of experiences behind you, and you can make your decisions in a blink, but those decisions aren't just tossed off decisions. They're based on what's happened to you before in those situations.
Right,
so
very good point.
Go fishing more. Go fishing
right,
more.
Exactly. We have a question about a green meanie. Are you familiar with the green meanie?
The green meanie, I'm not.
Okay.
I know a green weenie salmon pattern.
Let's see, maybe I said it wrong. Green weenie. No, it's
green weenie.
If you ever fished in West Virginia, they use a fly called the green weenie. Is this considered a nymph or a dry fly, or is it more like an egg or an egg sack? He's fishing both dry and wet.
I'm not able to answer that. That's
okay.
Ed Angle says that all fishing is regional, and that's too regional for me. I'm not
okay.
Sorry.
Okay. I just wanted to catch a few of those that have been coming in on the internet, and I want to always pay attention to those folks that are taking time to do that. Let's talk about wading here. We got a lot of questions about wading. Gary Nelson, Falls City, Nebraska says, could you compare and contrast nymphs that are weighted and nymphs that are unweighted but used with split shot? Are there advantages or disadvantages of using beadheads?
Well, I think I've mentioned that the beadheads give that flash, and they do give some weight. So, yes, there's advantages to using beadheads. Weighting itself, I do what I call underweighting. I've talked about this in my books, where the standard weighting wire is the diameter of the hook shank, and I'll use weighting wire if I can that's one size lighter. I also use non-lead wire now. I don't use lead wire anymore. And it's lighter. I actually weighed it on a reloading scale one time. It's 20% lighter. So you take one-fifth more turns to get the same amount of weight. But I typically weight my flies lighter than most people do, and that lets me do two things. It gives them more freedom underneath there. If I want to get them to the bottom, I can put on a split shot. I can always get them down. But it gives me the ability to fish them up high in the water column if I decide I want to do that. I do a lot of my fishing high in the water column with yarn indicators in those kinds of situations that Dennis talked about in New York a few minutes ago, where it's long, slow pool. The fish are not deep. I want to fish delicately to them. So I underweight my fly so that I have that choice of fishing higher in the water column with them. I always have a split shot and get them down.
Right. Well, we need to take another quick break here, Dave. When we return, we'll be answering more of your questions about using nymphs most effectively on streams and still waters. Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Do you know that it's possible to make your own bamboo fly rods? With the help of Power Fibers online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod-making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod maker profiles, classic tapers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit our website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com. We hope to hear from you soon. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Dave Hughes about nymphs for streams and still waters. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. Well, we're coming down to it here, our last stretch here, Dave. Let's try to hit a few more of these questions here. One question here again about the European nymphing techniques. Do you use those European nymphs? And this question is from Dan in New Jersey. Do you use those techniques?
I use them, but I use them kind of sparingly. And my reasoning, I actually put this in the book, is that when I go out on a stream, I'm rigged for, I want to be able to fish dry flies, wet flies, nymphs, whatever works. And so I'm going to be using a more typical, I'll use the word American rod. I'm going to be armed with that. And for these European techniques, you really need to be pretty specifically outfitted to do that. 10, 11, 12-foot rods and soft rods, really very soft rods that we don't typically use. And then I'll have to say, frankly, that don't work well for the other kinds of fishing that I do. So if you go out to a stream to do European nymphing correctly, you've got to be outfitted to do just that. And I'm rarely going to do that because I don't want to be that restricted. I'm away from the car. I don't want to be rigged to fish one way and suddenly a hatch starts and I want to fish the hatch and I'm not very outfitted to do it. So I think those European methods are more effective in catching numbers of fish in the waters that they're designed to work on.
Right.
But to me, it's a little bit restrictive, and maybe that's my way of saying I haven't done enough of it. But I think my other answer is I'm probably not going to do enough of it because I'm not going to be restricted to that type of fishing.
Okay. Now, here's two. I'm going to kind of combine two questions here. We've got one on the Internet from Dennis and Harpersville, New York again. Do you find the specialty nymph lines on the market today to be more advantageous than a regular floating fly line? And then another question from Joe Sloboda in Ohio. Can sink lines be used in fishing nymphs or sink tips? So can you kind of address the line issue that you use for nymphing?
Yeah, I use a floating line about 95 to 99% of the time on streams. And Hafe and I were fishing together the other day, and for some reason the question came up, and he had the same answer. On still waters, I'll use a lot of sinking lines. I'll use shooting heads and all kinds of stuff, and especially what I call a depth charge. But I think most of my sinking line fishing is going to be on still waters, or else it's going to be in the kinds of streams that have really deep pools. But there aren't many of those streams. So I would say that I just have to confess that my nymph fishing, all of my fishing on streams is done with a floating line.
Again, for flexibility, I take it.
Well, yeah, I guess that does answer it. If I'm want to fish a hatch, of course I'd carry a floating line on a spare spool, but I'd have to re-rig. But I just find a floating line and the typical split shot and indicator rig is going to catch me more fish.
Right, right.
So.
Question from Kevin Kutzner in Wyoming again. Frequently I fish water where it's either hard to tell what the depth is or there is constantly varying depths within short spans. Other than constantly re-rigging and guessing, are there any methods that I should be applying to this situation to best fish these conditions?
Well, I think, Kevin, the answer to that is that adjustable indicator, the indicator held on with a toothpick that lets you move it up and down. And instead of using one big split shot, use two or three small ones. And it is critical in those situations where the water is constantly changing depth. If you're going to fish 20 or 30 feet of water that has a change in depth, then you want to change to adjust to that. So, you know, number one, the indicator that you can move up and down instead of one that's fixed. And number two, putty weight or small split shot so you can add and subtract to your weight. But you want to adjust to that. And I want to get back to Dan and Joe's question from a second ago about sinking lines. I just remembered that I was fishing down in Chile not long ago on a really big river, and I used my lake depth charge line to get down to the bottom there and swing a streamer and a big nymph streamer or a big nymph across the bottom. And so I just recalled that on really big water that's pretty heavy with rain or something, that depth charge line can really be handy. So that was getting back to the earlier question.
Mm-hmm. And you, on still waters, are you using an intermediate, like the clear intermediate sinking lines? You like those?
I use that about a third of the time. I use that a lot.
Yeah, I like that a lot, too.
I use a clear under me. I actually had a situation this summer, last summer, where I was using a floating line and not doing well at all. And I didn't change anything except I took the time to restring my rod in a float tube with the clear intermediate. The way to do that, by the way, is to break your rod in half and string the halves and then put your rod back together. But at any rate, I took the time to change, and I immediately started catching fish on the same fly, same retrieve, same everything. Clear intermediate was the only difference. I don't think it even changed the depth I was fishing. So I don't know why. You know, you tell me, Roger, why did the fish respond that way?
Yeah, I don't know.
Happens often in my experience. I use a clear intermediate on still waters a lot of the time.
Yeah, seems to. That's a great new addition in the past few years to fishing still waters. Let's see here. We've got Mike in Ontario, Canada. He says, first, let me say I thoroughly enjoyed your book on nymph fishing. Perhaps others would be interested if you could elaborate a bit more on the Brooks method of fishing nymphs in big western rivers that you describe so well in the book.
Well, I don't use it as much as I used to, Mike, and it goes back to that. I'm fishing with a dry line now, and when Charlie Brooks was doing his fishing, we weren't using the strike indicator method. So what he was doing to get to the bottom was what needed to be done then, which was really heavily weight your fly, use the wet tip line. And that method is still extremely effective, and I'm not sure it's quite as effective as using a strike indicator. And maybe I should preface that by saying I had surgery on my right shoulder, and I've never been able to high stick since I had that surgery. And if you remember, Charlie Brooks' method used a big, heavy rod, a big, heavy fly, and he was standing up there with his right arm raised really high, and I couldn't do that anymore, unfortunately. So, but that method would still be extremely effective on the water that he described using it, which is the Madison around the barn holes in the fast water there.
Almost sounds like a European nymphing technique there again.
You know, there are similarities. I didn't think about that, but there are similarities there. And look at those Europeans are catching a lot more fish than we do. And I think if I fished Charlie Brooks's water next to Charlie, he'd catch a lot more fish than I did.
I think a lot of those runs in Eastern Europe are those deep runs where they're trying to get that fly down as quickly as possible, you know. So
exactly.
similar situations, I guess. Yeah. This is an interesting question. I know nymphing is the best way to catch fish, but I love to cast and find nymph fishing extremely boring. I've been substituting wet flies for nymphs, but do you have any secrets for making nymphing fun?
Well, you know, there is a point to what he's saying here, is that the casting gets reduced as opposed to dry fly fishing. But I think what makes it fun is to catch lots of fish in conditions where only nymphs will catch those fish. And once that happens, then you'll start having a lot of fun, because I think we'll all admit that catching fish is fun. And I think it's just a matter of using nymphs in a situation where something else won't work and finding out that, wow, nymphs work in this situation, and what I was using before doesn't work, then that'll turn it around, and you'll start having fun doing it.
Yeah, that's the immediate impression I got when I read the question is, if you're catching a lot of fish nymphing, you're having fun. At least I am.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not moaning or groaning about anything if I'm catching fish. I don't care how I'm catching them. You know, so.
I was on a panel one time with, I think Lefty Cray was on the panel, and Dave Whitlock. This is a long time ago, but somebody asked me if I thought that, this shows you how long ago it was, if I thought that strike indicators were ethical. And I said, well, I used to have a lot of trouble catching fish with strike indicators, and I thought they were unethical. But as soon as I started, I had that epiphanic moment that I talked about, where suddenly I caught a lot of fish, and suddenly I started catching more and more on them using indicators, and suddenly I thought, well, these things are ethical after all. So I think the word is situation ethics. But again, I started having fun because I was catching fish, and suddenly nymphing was fun.
Yeah. Well, here's a good question from Guy in Calgary, Alberta. He says, what do you think the most critical mistake the average angler makes when fishing nymphs in streams?
Well, I think the answer is pretty standard. It's not getting deep enough. I think if you're not getting your nymph on the bottom or within a few inches of it, then that's the biggest mistake, because you just won't be catching fish. I don't know how many times I've been fishing a situation and added one little tiny split shot, and suddenly I'm catching fish in a situation where I thought there weren't any fish around. So that's the, I think that's the critical mistake.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk in the last few minutes here. Let's talk more, because we haven't talked much about fishing nymphs in still waters. Let's see here. Larry Hall, Indian River, Michigan. The vast majority of literature concerning stillwater nymph fishing focuses on large western lakes and reservoirs. Chronomids, Calbatus, Scuds, Damsels seem to dominate the literature. How does all that relate to the Midwest? Are these the bread and butter nymphs for stillwaters in Michigan, or should we be tying something else?
Well, I think those are the bread and butter. I think the difference that you look at there is that those big western lakes and reservoirs, especially in Canada, have big midges. And you're not going to have those in the Midwest. The farther north you go, the bigger your midges get. That's why all the literature on midge fishing comes out of Canada, because the midges are bigger up there. And of course, if they're bigger, they're more easy to fish and more important. So I think what you've got to do is you've got to take all that midge fish. This is exactly what I do in my fishing here in Oregon. I take all that stuff that they've pioneered up there in Canada, the fishing with the indicator and the long leader and suspending that thing right over the bottom. I take that, but I use smaller nymphs to do it with. And then it works extremely well for me. So Larry, I think what you gotta do is you've gotta realize that the insects are pretty much the same in all lakes, but they're not all the same sizes. They're actually the same colors because they all blend with the bottom, except for the blood midges up there in Canada. But if you reduce the sizes of what those folks are talking about, it's going to work for you very well there. Just take everything that they say and just downsize it a little bit, and it's going to work for you.
We've got Martin in Lawrence, Kansas. When nymphing in still waters during the winter, what are some of the common depths or water columns to fish for different species?
Well, I think the answer there is that depth charge line. I think cast out that depth charge line. And when I say depth charge, I mean it's the fastest sinking head my rod will carry. Usually for me it's around, for my lake rod, it's a 300 or thereabouts, 250 to 300. And then count it down, 30 seconds to 60 seconds before you retrieve it. I was fishing a lake in Chile. I was with my wife in one boat, and Dave Whitlock and his wife were in another boat, and they were just hammering them. And it turned out that he had a faster sinking line, and he was counting down 30 seconds before he even started to retrieve. And then I went over, looked at his rig, and his rig was a great big streamer with a big split shot pinched about 2 inches in front of it. And I thought, man, he's really getting down there. And that was the difference. And I think very often in winter, that's the difference, is getting as deep as you can.
Got Alan in Colorado Springs, Colorado. I usually fish a private alpine lake at about 8,500 feet. Used to fish lures from the shore, but next season it's going to be from a belly boat. Any suggestion on technique or forms for a Colorado mountain lake? I guess, you know, techniques for fishing from a belly boat.
Yeah, I have one technique that I apply a lot in that kind of a situation, and I've even applied it in Colorado on some of those alpine lakes. But I'll rig with the clear intermediate that we just talked about, and I'll rig with a size 12, a small black bead-headed woolly bugger that I use a lot. I truncate it. I cut the tail short and everything, and that's become my favorite fly for lakes. And then about 18 inches behind that, I'll trail a zebra midge or something like that, a TDC, but a small midge pattern, a size 16. And then I'll cast that out, oh, maybe 50, 60 feet. Then I'll just paddle as slowly as I can. And the real critical thing here, I always say about lake fishing, the slower you go, the faster the fishing. The slower you retrieve, the faster the fishing. So if you remember in that belly boat, put your back to the wind or something, whatever you can do to slow you down, and just take a stroke with your fins once in a while. That slow movement is the real key to it. And then troll. If you get into an area where you find the fish, then use a real slow hand twist retrieve. But in just about any lake fishing situation I've been in, the slower the retrieve, the faster the fishing.
Interesting.
So that's my advice there.
All right. Now, this is a good question, and then we'll have to wrap things up here. Mike in Washington State, in the springtime, what is your first choice? And I would say at any time, but he says springtime. What is your first choice of water depth you target with a nymph if you observe no obvious insect or fish activities on a new piece of still water. Short, and then he says shoreline 1 to 3 feet, mid 3 to 8, or deeper 8 to 15.
Well, I like to think in spring in terms of fishing what I call the bottom of the shallows. You go into the shallow water because that warms up first. And what I mean by shallow is probably going to be around anywhere from 5 to 8 feet deep, maybe 10. And then I want a rig to fish my nymph maybe 18 inches or 2 feet above that. And what I'm going to do in that situation, Mike, is I'm going to do what Brian Chan does up there in Canada and Phil Rowley. And I fished with those guys, by the way, but they rig a strike indicator, and they find the depth of the water by putting their hemostat on the end of their line and dropping it down. Of course, they use depth finders. They have them on their boats, but I don't. So I just pinch my hemostat on the end of the leader, drop it down, find the depth, rig my indicator at that depth, and so that I'm suspending one or two midge patterns, usually two midge pupa patterns, about 18 to 24 inches above the bottom. And then I'll just sit and watch that indicator. So my answer is, what I'm doing here is I'm fishing what I call the bottom of the shallows. And the bottom of the shallows are going to be maybe anywhere from 5 to 10 feet down. And I'm going to want my fly about 1.5 to 2 feet above that bottom. And I hope that's the answer. But again, that's going to depend on the depth of your water. You've given 1 to 3 feet here, 3 to 8 feet, 8 to 15 feet. Whatever that depth is, I'm going to want my fly suspended 1 or 2 feet above that bottom.
Above the bottom, good.
And the other thing, if there's cruising fish, which happens to me a lot in spring, fish taking midges, I'll actually suspend a midge pupa pattern maybe a foot underneath the indicator. But Mike's question was if there's no visible fish, so we'll leave that
out. Right. Good. Well, Dave, unfortunately we've run out of time, and we covered a lot of ground. I'm happy that we did. There were a ton of questions online I didn't get to, and many more that came in advance. We do the best we can, folks. We sure appreciate you sending in those questions, but we'll just have to have Dave back another time to talk more about fishing.
There you go.
Stick with me, Dave, here. We're going to do our drawing here shortly for the 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, that 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, and, of course, that copy of your new book, Nymphs for Streams and Still Waters. So stick with us, folks. We'll be right back. Just as Lance Armstrong says, live strong, there's a fly fishing organization that's helping women battle cancer to fish on. It's Reeling and Healing Midwest. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature, and support network, which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of trout, flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and to learn how you can help support their retreats, visit www.reelingandhealingmidwest.org. That's reelingandhealingmidwest.org, or call them at 866-237-5725. That's 866-237-5725. 237-5725. Just a reminder to everyone tonight before you leave our website, please take a minute and give us your feedback on the show. You'll find a link on our homepage there in the Dave section that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave a few comments. We'd love to hear what you're saying. And now it's time to give away our prizes. And the first thing we're going to do here is draw for the Federation of Fly Fishing membership. It's a 3-year membership, and it's always great to be a member of the Federation and support their causes. And this way you can get to know them by getting the first 3 years free. Or if you win and you already have a membership, we can get that extended for you. And if you want to learn more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. So let's see. We'll do our drawing here, and we've got Leslie Rickson. Leslie Rickson, I bet you she is a member. Leslie was a couple years ago the designated fly tire for Team USA. I think it was Portugal, but I could be wrong about that. But anyway, Leslie, great. Glad you won that 3-year membership. Congratulations. That will give away that one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, and you can learn more about Fly Fusion Magazine at flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com. This is a magazine out of Calgary, Canada, a wonderful, beautiful, colored and well-put-together magazine that I know anybody would love to subscribe to. And we've got, our winner is William Hefner, and he's in Pennsylvania. So congratulations, William. We will contact you both about getting these subscriptions and memberships started. Okay, so now our big prize here tonight is Dave Hughes' book, Nymphs for Streams and Still Waters, again, courtesy of Stackpole Books, which we really appreciate them supporting our show tonight. And also, by the way, his book, If You Don't Win, which most of you won't, all but one, you can find Dave's book on our new books page from our homepage, and also on, we've got a link from Dave's speakers page where it links to a lot of his other books. I don't know if I have them all out there, but you can see a lot of Dave's other books through that link. I'm sure once you get one, you'll want others, so there's a good resource to find out a lot of the titles that Dave's written. Okay, Dave, here's the question I'm going to throw out there. We've covered a lot of ground, but there was a lot of talk about rigs, and I know you even wrote a whole book on rigs, but you had one preferred method. Now, which was Dave's preferred method? Was one fly, two flies, or three fly rigs? What was the method? Which rig did he prefer, one, two, or three flies when nymphing? So the first person to send that in, just go to our homepage, type that in, make sure you put your name and your location, and we'll see who wins. Somebody was trying to anticipate the question. Because I've asked this, what's your favorite fly? Nope, sorry. That wasn't the question tonight. And here, we got Joel Wilson in Sheridan. I don't know if that's Sheridan, Wyoming, or which Sheridan, but he says a two-fly rig. Is that your favorite setup there, Dave?
Yeah, I think that's it. Yes,
that's it.
I use one, I don't catch as many fish, and if I use three, I get tangles.
Pretty simple, right? Make that choice, amazing. Right? Well, great. Well, I know Joe is going to love your book, and the rest of you, well, go to our site, and you can get links to find that out on Amazon, and you can get your book there. Congratulations, Joel. And, Joel, please send me your name, address, and contact information either through the method you just did or to info@askaboutflyfishing.com so I can get your information to Stackpole, and they can get you your book. Well, great. I know he'll be happy with that. Well, Dave, hey, I really appreciate you being with us. I thoroughly enjoyed it. We covered a lot of ground, but like I said before, not enough. And I hope you'll join us and come back. And you've got a lot of subjects you've written on, and we'd love to learn from you in the future if you would come back. So you've got the invitation open.
Well, I appreciate it. I had fun, and there's a lot of ground covered and a lot more to cover. You never learn at all, that's for sure.
Well, it's been a lifetime journey for you, I know, and that's what makes it all interesting, I think, because that is a journey, not a destination. But.
And it's fun. Well,
good to have you. Well, our next broadcast will be on February 4th at 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and on that show, we're going to be interviewing Davey Wanton, and he's a professional guide on the White River in Arkansas, and no doubt one of the top experts on that river. You can learn Davey's secrets about hooking up with the monster browns on this show, so join us then. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Platte River Fly Shop, Keeney's Fly Shop, Powered Fibers Magazine, and Stackpole Books for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115. That's 888-961-1115, extension 2, and we'd be happy to explain the options to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive the announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.